It's rolling.
Just gonna go to the bathroom, but I'm here.
Me too.
I'm just letting you know.
I got you. You're hard to miss. Alright. Finishing federalism. So, that's there. Alright, so I did not have a chance to check the analytics yet on the videos. I will be checking, like I said in my both announcements, if the class is 100%, when I check all the way through, then you will all get extra credit. But seeing how the last time I checked it was like one person, I'm guessing there will be no extra credit. But unfortunately for you, that's some of the material that's on the desk. So if you didn't watch the videos, you gotta watch it because you're having your first exam next week. We're gonna finish up with grants. We're gonna talk about the Constitution of the Commonwealth. And then I will schedule when your exam is.
Is it a multiple choice exam?
Your exam will take place on Zoom. Not Zoom, Blackboard. And it is a mix of multiple choice and short essays. I will tell you.
I'm sorry, I got ahead of
myself. Yeah, no, it's a good question. It's just, I can't tell you because I base my dates on getting through where we need to get through. So as soon as we finish this, we'll finish grants today, and then we will talk about the Constitution of the Commonwealth, and then I will set you on your task. What I will do, as I always do, is I schedule it on an off day, so it's not a class day, and I open it up all day. From like 8 o'clock in the morning all the way till midnight. So all you need to do is just find some time during the day to sit down in a quiet place and take care of it. Because I know there's a bunch of students that have accommodations and I do it this way, so that way you can find your quiet space. The exams themselves, like I said, multiple choice, short essays. I don't grade you for spelling, I don't grade you for grammar. So if you answer in bullet points and it's misspelled, I don't care. But the exam is timed. And I throttle you in that you can't go back. It's one question at a time. So you answer it, then you go to the next one. If you skip it, it will be marked wrong. Typically, I schedule the exams to be 60 minutes. So I give you enough time so that way, in my mind, you spend about a minute for each multiple choice question. Read what's there, read the choices, think about it, answer, move on to the next. And then give yourself, 10 to 15 minutes per essay question. It's very rare that I have students that run out of time. So as long as you jump in and you just stay focused, you can get it done. All right, lots to do, little time to do it. Federal grants. So I finished up with federalism. The one thing I realized when I shut the recording off for the second class was I forgot to mention on my website, or maybe I did, I don't remember, in your class page, so PSC 221, in there, in addition to all of the PowerPoints and all of the outlines, there's a document called The Advantages and Disadvantages of Federalism. I would like you to read that. Add that to your study materials, because there may be an essay on the exam where I ask you to say, oh, what's an advantage or disadvantage of the federalist system in which we currently have. All right, going back to the tail end of the layer cake period.
The United States government, after passage or ratification of the 16th Amendment, began using money to coerce the states to comply with federal policy. There is an old adage which can be seen in several significant cases, Supreme Court cases. And it's a truth, a truism. With money comes control. The federal government literally uses cash to get the states to comply because the states always need more money. And by the way, the states do that to the cities and towns as well. They promise grants, they promise this free cash, but if you accept the grant, there's all kinds of terms and conditions built with it. So, where does that leave us? Well, with this simple point. Simple point. By the way, the use of grants really exploded during the LBJ's Great Society period in the 1960s. That was ultimately how the federal government sought to fight the failed war on poverty, because the federal government simply began redistributing money to the states to support all kinds of welfare programs. And again, I'm not bashing any individual program, but the truth is there's still poverty, so ultimately all of that money, you could argue that was wasted. Now, grants serve several purposes in theory, beyond just trying to control the states. And we will be fair-minded in this. First and foremost, if Congress has a new program and a law is passed, it's easier to have the federal government have the states maintain the program. So if Congress wants something, they kind of got to pay for it. But in the grants themselves, they can put certain terms and conditions, such as minimum standards that have to be maintained in order to continue to receive the funds. Grants also allow for flexibility, because some of the grants, like block grants, they're kind of like open-ended. You know, so the federal government will say you have to use money to improve education, but they leave it up to the states on how exactly they are going to implement programs to achieve those goals. And most importantly, it gives the states the ability to opt out. There is nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says the states are obligated to maintain any federal program. And states can opt out at any time. But the catch is, then they lose the money. Which means the state politicians will have to make cuts to programs that coincidentally might result in them not getting reelected. All right, your book lists 4 or 5 different forms of grants. And I apologize, I have not looked in the book in a while, and I'm pretty sure all the ones I'm gonna list match up. Because when I do something like this, I always try to make sure that you can look these up in the book. Pretty sure they're there, and I'm pretty sure they're described the same way I'm going to describe them. But in chapter 2, which is the Federalist chapter, you can look up grants and see what they have there. All right. The first type of grant are known as categorical grants. Categorical grants. And the type of grant is literally in the name. There are different grants that are offered for different categories. And if you are interested to apply, you can apply. But the catch is, they are for specific programs. So for instance, the federal government offers money for cities and towns to engage in bridge reconstruction. We in Sutton recently received an update that our request for a grant was approved, and we are going to engage in a project, groundbreaking is probably in 2027, in which we're going to replace a bridge in town that was built in 1935. There is no way the town of Sutton could afford that because of state laws and regulations. The estimated cost for the bridge is something like $30 million. When you consider the town of Sutton's annual budget currently is $40 million, you know, we don't have the means to pay for it. So what we did is we applied for a specific bridge grant, and it was approved. So we will be getting a grant to help us fix a bridge, which is necessary because if the bridge fails, it's going to cut off a whole section of our town from the rest of the community. Whereas categorical grants are narrowly defined for specific purposes, block grants are pretty much open-ended. They're open-ended for broad purposes. So, block grant, we'll give you money for education. What does that mean? Well, if you want, some communities could use it to hire new staff. Some communities could use it to buy new computers. Some communities could use it for, you know, new textbooks. Build-in renovations. Building a new sports field. You know, whatever. So long as it's something to do with schools, you can get it. Now, by the way, with a categorical grant, the government inspects the progress. So if with our bridge grant, every 6 months we have to submit reports to Washington, D.C. To just kind of let them know, here's how things are progressing. With a block grant, the recipient only needs to report that it's completed. We used it up. And of course, provide receipts or proof that we used it for what we were supposed to use it for. A good example of a block grant was something that was passed under the previous administration called ARPA. ARPA was the American Recovery... I forgot what the P was, American Recovery Something Act. This was COVID relief. This was passed by the Biden administration when COVID was in full effect and everything was locked down. The federal government passed a multi-trillion dollar bill and redistributed that money to the states. But within the grant, the monies had to be used for infrastructure purposes. So what did we use it for in Sutton? We reconstructed a septic system for our town hall. We upgraded wastewater treatment plant at our school. And we fixed the sewerage line. So we tried sticking to the broad rules and using it appropriately. But that was a block grant.
There are also sometimes the federal government just gives free money away. The states does the same thing with the towns. At the state level, the revenue sharing grant for Massachusetts, it's referred to as UGA, which is unrestricted general aid. So pretty much we just get a check and we can do it, put it in our budget, we can use it however we want. Now, the state has a formula and it's based on population and the economic stability of the community. So obviously with UGA funds, the poorer communities tend to get more per resident than my town, which is adjudged to be a wealthy town.
Federal government does the same thing. If they got extra money in the books, they'll sometimes just send blasts out to the states. Now, of these broad categories, most have some type of formula in it,
in which the grantor defines the conditions under which you can receive the grant. Or it may be a formula to determine how much money you get.
So just to keep it real simple, I'll stick with my UGA example. So I believe it's the Ways and Means Committee in the state legislature. That's the committee that deals with all the money. They simply have this formula in which they can plug and play. All right, we got $10 million to give out. And based on our formula, Sutton is going to get like $16,000. Whereas Worcester might get $100,000.
And the other type of grant, again, it could be a categorical grant, a block grant, a revenue sharing grant, is project grants. You may be able to apply, instead of applying for a broad category, just for a specific money.
So some states, although Massachusetts doesn't do it frequently, will award money based on a project that you're already engaged in.
Actually, that's not true. Massachusetts doesn't. So a lot of communities are building new libraries. The libraries are funded by a proportion. So typically it's like 60% of the town pays for it, and the 40% comes from the state. But you would apply for a project grant after you've already designed the project and you're ready to go forward with it. Yes? No, typically it's new construction. Schools, a lot of the new high schools and middle schools, elementary schools that have been built, you know, in the Commonwealth over the last 3 years as a result of that. So, in a project like that, so mine, we had in Sutton, we had a high school, middle school project in which we renovated a portion of our high school but attached it to a completely new middle school. So, in that sense, it kind of got built in, but I don't know if they necessarily have specific grants for upkeep or repair. They might, but I don't know.
All right, these are just the five broad grants. There may be more, but these are just the ones that I've seen in my own personal experience.
Any questions about any of those?
And again, obviously, if a city or town gets the money from a state, they got to follow through. Just like if a state gets money from the federal government, they got to follow through. Because with money comes control. All right. Now, are there limits to what the federal government can use money to achieve? Interestingly enough, the answer is yes. And that limit was defined by the Supreme Court. Going back to the second pre-recorded lecture when I was talking about new federalism, this case is a good example of the starting stages of limiting the federal government's power to control the states and to revert some authority or choice back to the states. And I like this case because it's kind of funny. So, the facts of this case, not that you need to remember the facts, are the Supreme Court basically analyzed whether or not there was a limit on the authority of the United States government to use money to coerce the states. And what it involved was a federal law.
The National Drinking Age Act, 1984.
Prior to this law,
going back to the early 1970s,
the drinking age in the majority of the states was 18. But
this was in part of Congress's attempts, and they did many things, such as lowering the voting age, also, by amending the Constitution. This was many of one of a series of political moves aimed at trying to tamper down of hippies and all of their anti-Vietnam War protests. Because the kids at the time were making a pretty good argument. Wait, I'm going to get drafted, I'm going to go to war and die, but I can't vote and I can't drink? So it was like 70, it was during the Nixon administration that both were passed. But essentially what happened was is the federal government basically said, okay, you're 18, you can drink. Problem was what grade level are people in, generally speaking, when they're 18 years old?
Senior, freshman, college.
Yeah, they're a high school senior, they could be a high school junior, they could be a college freshman. So guess what all these kids were doing? Going to school, drunk. They were going to school completely shit-faced, inebriated, bombed. School fights went up, school truancy went up, car accidents went up, and it was a real problem. So much so that a group that would be formed called MAD was formed. Mothers Against Drunken Driving. And they began to lobby Congress to take action. Because kids are dumb and they were killing each other. So this convinced Congress to move. 1984, they passed a law
suggesting, let's be true, they demanded
that the drinking age across the country be increased to 21. Why 21? What?
You're out of school.
You're definitely out of high school, chances are. But is there something in terms of maturity, physiologically speaking, that makes 21 the ideal age to start drinking? Is their brains fully developed? Is your brain going to be fully developed when you turn 21? When does brain development stop? I think 25. Truth of the matter is, there is no answer. Just traditionally, in Western civilization, going back to the ancient Greek times, 20 or 21 was usually presumed to be the point when you were considered an adult. Because usually by 21, you were married, you had kids, and you had your family farm up and running. So, Congress basically threw a dart at the wall and basically said, we'll just make it 21.
Now here's the kicker. Here is the kicker. The Constitution of the United States.
In 1930, maybe 31, maybe 32, I don't remember exactly. FDR was in the White House. Prohibition, which had been in place for for over a decade came to an end with the ratification of the 21st Amendment.
And in the 21st Amendment, it literally states that it is the domain of the states to control anything alcohol-related. That there is no federal jurisdiction.
But yet now we have Congress passing a law that is seemingly in violation of the 21st Amendment. Unconstitutional! How did they get away with it? Very simple.
They told the states they could choose. They had choice.
If you choose to increase your drinking age, because it's a state law, to 21, we will give you 100% of highway funds. But if you choose not to, prior to, so we will say, less than 1988, if you do not enact it by 1988, you will see a 5% reduction.
Which now is supposed to be greater than 1988.
And if you do not do it by 1992, you will only receive 90% of your highway funds.
And that's where they stopped.
So, they're not telling the states, if you don't do this, you're going to lose all of your money. We will still fund the highways, but you'll see a reduction. And by the way, 10% of several hundreds of millions and millions and millions of dollars is a lot of money.
But ultimately, this is the choice. States can keep it or not. Well, here's the funny thing. Just about every state moved to switch it to 21. But South Dakota had an interesting scenario.
Near beer. Near beer is, it's not non-alcoholic beer. It's just less alcohol. So technically any beer that has an alcohol percent of 3% or lower is classified as a near beer. So in South Dakota, they increased the age limit to 21 on everything but near beer, and they allowed anyone older than 19 to drink.
Why?
Well, there were a couple of near beer manufacturers that were in South Dakota, so they're trying to support local industry. And South Dakota argued that statistically, they actually have no evidence that even young kids that consume near beer caused any significant alcohol-related motor vehicle fatalities. And they argued 21st Amendment. We want to keep this. We're allowed to under the Constitution. So guess what Congress did? They cut their funds by 5%. So South Dakota sued.
Now FYI, under Article 3 of the U.S. Constitution,
any legal case in which a state is a party has their trial before the U.S. Supreme Court. So South Dakota sued Ronald Reagan's Secretary of Transportation. They go before the Supreme Court and they argue, look, we got stats, we got data. No fatalities of kids drinking near beer. 21st Amendment.
We have a legitimate right to keep this at 19%. Well,
here's the interesting thing. The court kind of agreed with Congress and also kind of agreed with the states.
So what they did was develop a test, which now is the basis for viewing the legality of any grant that Congress wishes to pass. General welfare. That's what I thought.
First, the grant cannot be designed to be punitive. Any grant given by the United States government to the states must be for the general welfare. In other words, it must be for the good of the people. Two, it must allow choice. If a state wants to opt out, they should be allowed to. And three,
projects, programs. That was messy. Let's try that again. Programs.
If the federal government is going to give a grant, it must be a grant that's based on something that Congress actually has the constitutional authority to get involved with. At the basis of this law is what? What are the funds directly linked with? Highway. Who controls interstate commerce? Who controls interstate transportation? The federal government. Is this law, which is designed to give highway funds, is it linked to a legitimate government, national government program, purpose? Can South Dakota say no? Yeah, they could have said no, we don't want that extra 10%. We'll be okay with 90%. And lastly, is keeping drunk kids off the road something for the common good? So the Supreme Court said to that grant, it's fine. It's constitutional. Every single grant that you hear about is subject to the same scrutiny, the same test, if challenged. But if it's related to something that it's good for the people, something that it's the domain of the federal government and the states can opt out, it is what it is. You don't like the terms and conditions? Opt out.
Questions? All right. Well, here is the problem, though, that began developing when Bill Clinton was president. And it was perpetuated when W was there and Obama was there. More and more, Congress is passing what is commonly referred to as
funded mandates.
An unfunded mandate is a federal program, and they're making the states pay. So, for instance, if a state wants to build a connector, and the connector between highways has no legitimate federal purpose, the states can do so. It will get added into the, you know, the little red, white, and blue shield, the Eisenhower Interstate Highway System, but the state's going to pay for it. But the Supreme Court has kind of sent mixed messages on unfunded mandates. So, for example, 1995, Congress passed, sorry, 85, Congress passed a law called the Low-Level Radioactive Waste Policy. Well, this law basically said, because back then there were a lot of nuclear power plants that were in operation. So, under this law, the states had to take possession of all of the toxic waste if the states didn't opt in to a federal regulatory policy. So basically, the U.S. government would start telling the states how it had to be stored, who could transport, where it had to go. So this law didn't give the states any extra money. It just simply said, do it the way we want you to do it, even if it's going to cost you more. Well, New York State sued, and the Supreme Court said, no, this restriction was legitimate. Because after all, if it's nuclear waste generated in New York, whose property is it? Because guess where New York used to dump all their stuff? Which state? New Jersey. So in New York v. United States, it upheld an unfunded mandate, but in Prince v. United States, it struck down an unfunded mandate. In Prince v. United States, real quickly, Bill Clinton, when he was president, the Democrats controlled Congress for both chambers for his first term. And one of the laws that he passed was a law called the Brady Act. The Brady Act. That was basically the assault weapons ban that was passed at the federal level that was later determined to be unconstitutional. Under that law, the federal government required the CLEOs, the chief law enforcer, in every single city and town. So we're talking local police to be the ones to conduct background checks and to approve the purchase of every single firearm within their city or town. Well, all of the police unions across the country aligned and sued the United States government. Case gets before the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court struck down that portion of the Brady Act. Because the federal government doesn't have the power to tell a local police officer what to do. And there was no additional money. Because you know how much time your local chief of police would have to spend
personally checking the background of every person who's buying a gun, and personally approving or rejecting every individual sale?
There's not enough hours in the day.
So the police union struck back against Bill Clinton administration, and the Supreme Court, as part of devolution, sided with the local cops.
But where does that leave us today? I don't know. Again, this is just examples of two sides of the same coin. In one area, you can have an unfunded mandate. In other areas, you don't. So unfortunately, I can't give you any general guidance other than just to bring it to your attention. Question on unfunded mandates. All right, seeing none. Now, there are some areas where the Constitution actually forces the states to engage in certain behaviors. Particularly, behaviors that involve cooperation. There are four areas in particular. First and foremost, from Article 4, Section 1, the U.S. Constitution requires all states to give what's known as full faith and credit to actions in other states. And what are we talking about? Well, public acts, public records, judicial proceedings. So, for instance, if you have a will, and you had your will signed in Florida, and in your will you discuss property that's in Massachusetts, Massachusetts must recognize that out-of-state will. Or if you are adopted under the laws of California, but your family moves to Wyoming, Wyoming must recognize that judicial proceeding, that formal adoption. Now, FYI, this does not apply to criminal judgments. This is only civil.
So, for example, if you go to Las Vegas and you get rolled over, as so many people do, and you have a gambling debt of $17,000, I've never been to one of the casinos that are down there, MGM or the Sands? I don't even know if that's real. We'll just say MGM. 17,000 of gambling debt. You can't get on a plane and come home and be like, neener, 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 you can't get me. MGM will file a claim in that state court, and the state court judgment will be enforced by our courts up here. So you cannot hide.
Questions? Another area where states are forced to cooperate? Privileges and immunities. Citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities to citizens of the several states.
This clause was intended to prevent discrimination by one state against the citizens of another.
So, for instance, if you are in possession of one of these, a Massachusetts driver's license, Massachusetts has given you the privilege to drive an automobile on the roads of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This little piece of plastic gives you also the privilege to keep in your car and drive into other states.
Because if you get pulled over in, say, Virginia, the police will ask you for your license and registration. You give them this, they will recognize this. Because you may not know this or not, you're not entitled to drive. That's not a right. Driving is a privilege.
Now, here's the thing, though. The Supreme Court over the years has allowed some discrimination. For instance, many colleges charge out-of-state tuition to kids that want to go into a different state to go to college. Supreme Court has said that's fine. States can charge different rates for hunting licenses or fishing licenses. States can deny you the right to vote. I mean, if you live in Massachusetts, you have no right to go up and vote in New Hampshire. Questions? But you know the one thing that states can't do? States can't deny fundamental rights. So free speech, habeas corpus, right to a judge, right to a jury. I mean, right to a lawyer, right to a jury, and so forth. The third area where the Constitution forces cooperation, the Interstate Rendition Clause. It was also found in Article 4. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2. According to the Constitution, and I quote, any person charged in any state with treason, a felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled be delivered up to be removed to the state having the jurisdiction of the crime. So, if you commit a homicide here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and you try fleeing down to, I don't know, say Arizona, if the Arizona police catch you, they will hold you in custody until such time as the governor's office submits a request for extradition. You will then be put in an orange jumpsuit, have shackles put on your wrists and ankles, and will have to do the perp walk and get put on a plane. And then you'll be flown back to Massachusetts, where you'll stand for trial. Why? Well, as it says in the United States, you have a right to be tried in any state in which you commit a crime.
So why are we going to make Arizona charge you for homicide? You did the time up here. So this way you can be tried before a jury of your peers.
Now, by the way, this does not apply to international
extradition. The United States government forms treaties with other countries that establish the extradition procedures. And generally, most of the treaties, there's a couple that allow for the states to get involved, but the bulk of the treaties deal with federal crimes.
Questions? Alrighty. The last click on this slide is the Interstate Compact Clause. In our Constitution, states are allowed to form compacts. Not quite alliances, but more than just a mere association. Basically, a compact is an agreement between states. Why? Well, think of our states. We're just a blob of land. When you go up to where, quote unquote, the borders are, you don't see any lines. You don't see any walls or gates. You know, we don't have a boundary around the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, like a trench. States, therefore, form regional compacts to deal with certain things that, you know, impact states in the areas. The example that I have is a compact called the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. This is a compact between the 15 states that line the Atlantic seaboard. Under this compact, it's the ASMMF that coordinates and manages the fisheries that are off the coasts. Well, here's the catch. Just because the states wanted to form the compact, it has to be recognized by Congress. Ultimately, this association was. It was agreed to in 1950. And the line that was used to lobby for the approval, fish don't recognize boundaries. Which makes sense. So what is the goal? Well, management, conservation, an effort, they collaborate to try to protect the delicate fishing waters that we have in abundance. I'm sure your book uses other examples, but that's just the one I have in my notes. Questions on anything related to federalism? All right, I'm going to give you a little bit, and then we're going to call it a class. If you use your little Google machine, and by the way, I am requiring you to do so, and you look up the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, you will find the entire document online. I am sure many of you did not even realize that Massachusetts has a constitution. But every single state does. And as it turns out, our Constitution is arguably one of the most unique documents that was written during the foundational period of our country. Why? What makes it unique? Two things. How it was written, and how it was adopted. How it was written, how it was adopted. While all 13 states would go and make their constitutions, first off, none of the other 13, other than Massachusetts, is still operating under its original constitution. And second, none of the other states use the democratic process to draft and approve their constitution. Just to give you a little bit of spoilers, the people in the towns voted for delegates to go to a convention to draft the constitution. And then once it was drafted, they brought the copies back to the towns, and the towns voted. No other state has ever done anything like it. All of the other states, it was controlled by the state government. Either the state government wrote the Constitution and adopted it without the consent of the people, or the state put together a commission that drafted the Constitution, which they adopted without the approval of the people. Only Massachusetts Did the people have a say on who made it and whether or not they wanted it? Now, real quick, give a little bit of history. Because we live in one of the most unique states, historically speaking. Of course, our history has been forgotten. But how we came into being is fascinating, in my opinion. From the very start, when the first Puritans crossed the Atlantic Ocean and came across and planted themselves on the soil of what would become Massachusetts, they literally had a blank slate in which to build a community. Unlike where they were coming from, over here, there were no lords. There were no nobles. There were no ancestral claims to lands that go back centuries. There were no laws of peasantry or serfdom. There were no common folk. And there was no distinction between who was rich and who was poor. Literally, there was nothing. So those first people who came over had the highest level of freedom than any other people who have ever lived on Earth. Nobody could tell them what to do in any regard. Why? The government was across an ocean, and there was no technology to spy on them or to check in. They were just here. And interestingly enough, the right to come here and have this freedom was literally contained in the document that gave them approval. And by the way, I'm not talking about the Pilgrims. Plymouth was a separate colony. I'm talking about Massachusetts Bay. The people who came over and started Massachusetts Bay got a grant from the king at the time, King Charles I. By the way, if you know nothing about King Charles I, he was the only king in English history that was beheaded by his own people. But in the grant, it gave full control to the company of Massachusetts Bay. The grant for Plymouth, the grant for Jamestown, the central authority was London. But in Massachusetts, the people here could do whatever they want. You know why? Here's the devious reason behind it. Most historians agree it's because King Charles hated the Puritans. He did not believe they could survive without a king, so he essentially allowed them to come over here to die. Because, right, isn't that general the consensus? You know, if you don't have an all-encompassing government, you know, people are so inherently stupid that we'll just end up killing each other. Well, amazingly, it did not happen. They took this charter, they organized, and they brought the charter with them over here so the king couldn't rip it up. And under this charter, all residents would be part of the government, which was called the General Court. If you were a citizen, you had the ability to be part of the government of the colony. But here's the catch. Here's the catch. You had to be a freeman. Freeman. If you were a freeman, you were considered a citizen. And if you were a citizen, could participate in the general court. What were you not if you were a free man?
What were you not if you were a free man?
What were you not if you were a free man? There were no slaves here. There were indentured servants, though. In 1629. Because slavery was illegal over here in 1629. But there were indentured servants. You know what the difference is? So yes, you were not a freedman if you contracted to come over here and you agreed to work for somebody for a term of years. You were not considered a citizen. You could not participate. Who also could not be a freedman. I'm not a freedman. That's a free form slave. A freedman. Literally, it's in the name. Women could not be a participant in the general court. Who also could not be? Everybody who was a freeman owned land. The only people who did not own land were indentured servants. And when? And who also couldn't own land?
Children.
Anybody else? There were no serfs. Indentured servants. The Indians. Absolutely. The Indians were not allowed to ever be citizens. Because in order to be a citizen in Massachusetts Bay, here's the kicker. And by the way, don't think they came over here for religious freedom. You've been lied to. You've been lied to about a lot of things. But that is a big one. They came over here for religious conformity. To be a citizen, you had to be a free man, an adult male over the age of 21, who was a member of the church. You had to be a member of the congregational church. If you could, then you could participate. And you could make decisions that impacted everybody. Now, I'm going to end it early, because I got to go to a meeting. But here's the interesting thing. It worked good for the first couple of boatloads of people that came over. What do you think is going to happen when the citizen population goes from a few dozen to a few hundred to a few thousand? It's not going to work anymore. Why not? Think, this is going to sound really weird. Think really practical.
No.
Partially, but not really. Did they have a building big enough to house a couple of thousand people? No, they did not. So the decision to change the initial system of government was based literally on the fact that they had no building big enough to squeeze everybody else in. And it would be fair if you got called to the general court and you got stuck outside and you couldn't hear what was going on inside? All right, so homework. Watch the videos. If you didn't watch the videos, you will have an exam next week. Look on my website. Look at the advantages and disadvantages of federalism. And open up the U.S. Constitution at some point and just familiarize yourself with the basic structure. All right. Have a lovely weekend. It was nice seeing you all, and I promise next week we'll start up regular classes, regular time.